When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, Jana Matthews, medievalist extraordinaire, and I cover Sansa's first POV chapter. This is the chapter where Joffrey gets what's coming to him from Arya and Nymeria. And of course, things get complicated between Sansa and Joffrey. And Steve and I talk about Season 2, Episode 6, The Old Gods and the New. Don't forget to rate and review on iTunes or wherever you download podcasts. Without further ado, here is Boss Mang Aeron.
Ask Aeron anything!
Okay, Aeron, worst Game of Thrones actor among the main cast.
It's gotta be Shay, right? She qualifies the main cast.
I would think so. Yeah.
Jim
never liked Shay very much. I don't have that big of a problem with Shay. I mean, I think, well, keep going. I want to hear what you say.
I mean, I just think that I just feel like in the main cast, she always had trouble, and the thing is it's kind of a tough character to play. Like, maybe my dislike of her is a lot, but like, I don't know, like the way that like the Double D's and George Martin talk about this actor is like she came in and just completely blew them all away and wowed them and all that, and I'm like, and I never saw it. And then the more I know about Double D's and the more like I know about George Martin, like, I don't know. I don't know. Because like, that's the thing. It's like, I'm trying to think of main cast and everyone, even the ones that started off a little rough, like some of the Stark children. I think, you know, there's some things you could criticize about Kit Harington in the early goings. But, you know, I've seen him do really good comedy. I've seen him do really good drama, obviously. Like, everyone's pretty strong. That's the one that I keep coming back to, like.
I think and Kit I don't think Harington gets stronger. I think Jon Snow becomes a more interesting and stronger actor as the thing progresses. And for whatever reason, I think Bran gets a lot worse. So, well, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know whether that was just a choice or
he didn't get whether. Yeah, he didn't get to stretch his wings nearly, you know. Yeah. I mean, he was carried around by Hodor for most of the series, so, like, he didn't get a lot of the dramatic range. In fact, a lot of stuff when he was being dramatic, it's like he just rolled his eyes back in his head and went comatose, like, right? I think that, like, the thing about Shay is that, like, I also don't think that her and Dinklage had a lot of chemistry. Like, I'm supposed to believe that this is the woman that he's going to burn. But that's the thing is, I keep warring with myself. It's like, well, that's the story, right? But the meta narrative is that Tyrion is starving for any kind of authentic affection.
Yeah, if you can convince Tyrion that you love him just for him,
yeah,
you can totally.
Which is different than loving him for his gold, which he has experienced hundreds of times with women all over Westeros. And that's the thing. It's like, do I need to believe there's natural chemistry there? Do I need to believe that she's just got him wrapped around her finger? But then there's got to be some of that natural chemistry for me to believe that. And I just
I think there was. I don't know. It's weird how some actors just rub you wrong. Like I hate Russell Crowe.
Ah.
I just hate him. But I know that a lot of people love him. And I don't really have a good reason to hate him.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is. It's all me. It's Russell, it's not you. It's all me.
Yeah. I have a little bit of that with Mark Ruffalo.
Yeah,
where it's like, I actually like his characters a lot, but it's like he's got this one thing where he kind of just kind of like gazes to the middle distance and does a pouty face. And like, that's his go-to.
You Can Count On, there's a movie called You Can Count On Me.
Uh-uh.
It's really good. It was the first thing I saw him in, and he was fantastic. He, you know, he's kind of like a...
He's been fantastic in a lot of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And I always kind of... It's a little bit weird. Like, the first thing you see someone in, if they impress you...
Yeah.
Then you kind of forgive them in other performances.
Yeah.
What did you think about Littlefinger? What's the actor that did Littlefinger? Do you remember his name?
Aiden something or other, right?
Right. What did you think of him in The Wire?
Oh, I thought he was great. In fact, I thought, knowing that I'd read the books and seen the series, I thought he was exceptionally well cast, because Baelish is kind of like Carcetti with, you know, writ large,
I totally
in a medieval setting, you know?
I totally
Aiden Gillen, that's his name.
Yeah, I didn't like him in The Wire. There was just something that rubbed me wrong. I just didn't.
Well, he's Littlefinger.
I just didn't get it. And then I thought, and then when I saw him in Game of Thrones, I always had a problem with him in Game of Thrones. I think it probably was colored by my experience of him in The Wire.
Yeah, I feel like that, like, David Simon's got this really black-pilled take on politics, where it's like the best you can hope. Because, like, all these politicians are sociopaths. The best you can hope for is one will align up with your personal beliefs and you throw the cast a vote for them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't ever fall in love with these people. That. Don't ever think that these... And I actually think that that's, like, not a bad way to look at it, because then you're never going to get, you know, disillusioned because your hero turns out to be, you know, an abuser of women, or he commits war crimes, or it's like, well, you know, that's just a sociopath that kind of sort of has my... governmental preferences.
The trouble with that, because I have a good friend who takes that view of politics, and I think the trouble with that is that it allows for people who are truly moral monsters to get away with all kinds of shit that they shouldn't.
Yeah,
because everyone's that bad.
That's true.
So I don't know. I mean, I'd like to believe that some people actually do believe that they're making the world a better place.
Yeah. I think the set of those people exist. And I think that, like, certain political climates are conducive to those type of people and certain political climates are not. And maybe, you know, we've been in a political climate for the last 30, 40 years that is conducive to the psychopaths. And maybe, you know, if we can do our due diligence as citizens over the next generation mm-hmm. or so, we can leave our children with an environment that's more conducive to, you know, like, you know, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington types, like the Jimmy Stewart types, the people who are to have, you know, that have a genuine compassion and care for people and want to do good governance. But we'll see.
If you have a question for Aaron or Anthony, you can send those to book@baldmove.com.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Back... by popular demand, Jana Matthews, Associate Professor of Medieval Literature at Rollins College. Did I get that right, Jana?
Yeah, that's perfect.
All right, good. Jana, when's the last time you called someone a prancing jackanapes?
Just 2 minutes ago. No, I can't say I've ever called anyone a prancing jackanapes, but I sure do like that terminology, and I'll put it on my list.
Yeah, this is what Barristan calls Renly, and after reading this chapter, it has been on my mind, and so this morning I called my son a prancing jackanapes.
Perfect. But yeah, I hope that your son is a teenager.
He's 13, and it did indeed drive him to a dictionary. So
there you go.
Mission accomplished. So Renly's a prancing jackanapes, and I have to say, rereading this chapter, which is, I mean, it's just riveting. The chapter itself, there's so much happening, and it's so tragic. And I'm, you know, we're meeting a few of these characters for the very, very first time, but I found myself really kind of enjoying Renly on this reread.
Yeah.
Before we get going, how do you feel about Sansa?
Sansa's a fascinating character just because she's so, I think, grounded in the traditional notions of medieval femininity, at least the ones that, the Victorians have kind of isolated. You have to love her and hate her reading her from a 21st century kind of post Me Too movement perspective. And on one hand, she so badly wants to ascribe to those ideals and then standards that of womanhood and femininity that have been established for her. But yet, you know, from the very get-go in this chapter, you know that that's just not going to happen. The circumstances of her life are just going to force her outside that box.
I feel like I hate her. I hate her guts. Right. And yet I feel guilty about it because she's like 11 and like, come on, she's 11. How can you fault her for any of this?
I think what's so fascinating about this particular chapter really, I mean, deals with kids.
Yeah.
You know, we've got an 11-year-old, a 9-year-old, and Joffrey's 12. And so these are kids, and what you're seeing here is just like how thoroughly they are conditioned and trained to live into the social position and standing mm-hmm. in which they've inherited, right, for better or for worse. And so again, like you said, you want to shake her out of it, and you want to say, you know, there's so much more. There's a different model and way you can do this. But then you also look at her with tremendous empathy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do a little synopsis of the chapter here. As Sansa anticipates her big day of riding in the queen's wheelhouse, she can't stop herself from thinking about Joffrey, her betrothed prince, and everything she's ever dreamt of. She finds Arya at the river brushing Nymeria and argues with her about pretty much everything. Arya has no intention of riding with the queen, doesn't much like the queen, would rather explore downriver with the butcher's boy who smells like a meat block. Sansa gives up and returns to camp to meet Barristan the Bold, Renly Baratheon, and although he scares her, Illyn Payne. In her exchange with the Hound, she confesses that she's terrified of Sir Illyn, and this gets the entire party laughing at her, which is something of a social nightmare for her. Joffrey saves her, and the two go riding together down the Trident. What begins as a lovely date turns into mayhem. Joffrey cuts Micah, Arya smashes Joffrey's head, Joffrey swings a sword at Arya, and Nymeria takes Joffrey down by his arm. After Arya menaces Joffrey, she throws his sword in the river. Sansa tries to comfort her beloved prince, only to see his true face. He has nothing but contempt for her. Dun dun dun! Joffrey's true face is revealed. I read this chapter a couple times because it was so enjoyable. It feels like things have been building and building and building, and all of a sudden it's like, wow, there's so much action that's just packed right in here.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. This is a great chapter.
I feel like Martin's, in this chapter, Martin's use of the sort of first person limited POV really works well for him, because what we're doing here is we're seeing characters like the Hound and Illyn Payne and Joffrey and Arya through Sansa's eyes. And even though Sansa kind of hates Arya, for instance, or resents her or whatever sisters do, I love Arya. So it's like I'm viewing through Sansa's limited perspective, and yet I'm loving her sister all the more because of it.
Absolutely. I think that really we were getting a good glimpse of Arya and her spirit and her fiery passion for life, and I think just her individuality. And, you know, ultimately, like, what Sansa, even at this really young age, mm-hmm. Has this model that she's trying to aspire to. And it's a box she's trying to fit herself into. And Arya is just a reminder that box is artificial, and that it's constructed, and mm-hmm. that box is highly unpleasant. And so I think what you see is Sansa pushing back at what she perceives to be a rejection of all the values that she has, but there's also this sense of that Arya is like reflecting poorly on her and her ability to climb up the social ladder and to be kind of the person that she envisioned and always wanted to be is being inhibited by her sister. Mm-hmm. And that can be like a really painful thing to live with, but that is also something that Sansa's going to have to grapple with throughout the rest of this novel.
So I'm just going to read this. Let me turn on a light here so I can actually see what I'm... The sun went behind the clouds in Dayton, Ohio.
Oh, you're in Dayton?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I grew up in Bellbrook.
You're kidding me.
No, I grew up in Bellbrook. My whole family, like from like 18,000 generations back, is from, I was born in Kettering Hospital and yeah.
So I thought that you spent some time in LA or something like that.
Yeah. So I moved when I was in, middle school out to LA. Uh-huh. But my whole family still lives in the Kettering area, in Dayton area.
That's so funny.
Yeah. Right. I love it there.
Yeah. Wow. I had no idea that. I thought we like had the California connection.
Yeah. No. Right. So, I mean, yeah, I went to high school there, lived in California, love it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, right. I think it's odd to move from both of us have the California and Ohio
funny.
Thing.
That's funny. Yeah. All right. So let me just read this little section. Sansa already looked her best. She had brushed out her long auburn hair until it shone and picked out her nicest blue silks. She had been looking forward to today for more than a week. It was a great honor to ride with the queen. And besides, Prince Joffrey might be there, her betrothed. Just thinking it made her feel a strange fluttering inside, even though they were not to be married for years and years. Sansa did not really know Joffrey yet, but she was already in love with him. He was all she ever dreamt her prince should be. Tall and handsome and strong, with hair like gold. She treasured every chance to spend time with him, few as they were. She treasured every chance to spend time with him, few as they were. The only thing that scared her about today was Arya. Arya had a way of ruining everything. Arya represents the thing that Sansa most fears,
mm-hmm.
That Arya is going to embarrass her in front of the popular kids.
Oh, 100%. And that more importantly, like she's going to embarrass her, and that embarrassment or having the crazy uncle or the crazy uh-huh. aunt in the family that is going to prevent you from marrying well and from like living into your hopes and aspirations. And so I think that isn't that sort of the fear of horror that goes into, I think, every, aspiring elite, right? It is the sense that other people's behavior determines your social trajectory.
That's right. And it's also got kind of like a, I don't know, like a High School Musical vibe a little bit.
100, yeah.
Where it's like...
Totally.
Sansa's like this close to her dream. She's like inches away from everything she ever wanted. And she's making like a first impression on a bunch of new popular kids. And her little sister is just going to ruin it. And guess what? Arya ruins it. She ruins it for Sansa. And, of course, you can't blame Arya for anything in this chapter. Arya was brave and she was everything that Sansa wasn't. But Sansa's got a point. Arya is just going to ruin everything.
Just her very existence, I think. And I think what's also fascinating is that the confrontation happens far away from, from civilization. Like Arya, she goes and she plays and she does this play acting, not in the middle of everything. She tries really hard not to make a scene. But like they find her.
Yeah.
And so that's it. And so that's even one more reason why, this scene becomes so comedic, but also so deep and rich, is because they intrude on her space. It's not the other way around.
Right, right. So that's totally right. And you were saying before, using the metaphor of a box before, mm-hmm. like a social box. Well, there actually is a literal box in this chapter. It's the wheelhouse.
Yep.
And I love the two sisters' perspective on the wheelhouse. For Sansa, it represents the center of the universe. It's not the center. It's like the whole universe. She'll be in the wheelhouse. It'll be the queen. There'll be lemon cakes, and Joffrey might be there. And so she's telling Arya about this, and Arya's like, I don't want to be in there. You can't even see outside. And then Sansa says, why would you even want to look outside? Like, there's nothing to see out there. Everything in the whole universe is in that little box. Anyway, I think it works really well as a metaphor.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that perfectly encapsulates their world visions at this particular moment in time.
Yeah, Arya's thinking, I'm going to go down river with Mike. I'm going to find the lost rubies of, you know, the trident and, you know, pretend to be a knight. It's like each of them has the perfect day planned, right?
Mm-hmm. That's a good way of putting it. Perfect way. Yeah, and they both sort of ruin it for each other.
That's totally it. Totally it. Oh, goodness. Now, I come to love Sansa, as I think I'm supposed to love Sansa. But the little trick that Martin's playing here is that I think early in these chapters, Arya is just supposed to be so much more lovable. I think I'm supposed to sort of be drawn to Arya. But I, you know, not everyone sees it that way.
I think everyone inherently roots for the underdog, sure, and for the misfit. And maybe that's part of just the culture of readers. As a kind of self-avowed misfit himself, Martin has tremendous empathy for characters who don't fit the mold. And maybe as academics, we too gravitate towards figures who are most like ourselves, you know, weird and different and, you know, like march to the beat of our own, mm-hmm, of a different drum. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, to that end, this is a whole story about, at least in terms of King's Landing, about a group, about royalty, and about expectations and behaviors and codes that are set and that are determined and dictated in fate. And we have a figure who wants to push against that and to really challenge it. And that's what makes it interesting. And I think from the very get-go, Martin reminds us that the most memorable, the most interesting, the most powerful individuals in any story are those who don't conform.
Right. And it's those characters who have the most trouble, right? And trouble's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Trouble's very interesting. Sansa courts that, but definitely Arya does as well.
Yeah. Okay. So at the end of this, who's has the worst predicament, Arya or Sansa? Because they both get their perfect day ruined, right?
Mm-hmm. I love that. I love the fight scene for so many reasons. And then I'm going to take this into PG-13 territory, okay, which you probably will want to edit out. But I was just teaching a medieval literature class a few hours ago, and we were talking about Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, you know, and like there's sort of this big, long descriptive scene where they're talking about the knight's swords. And, you know, I kind of like jokingly said, but I really sort of meant it seriously, that anytime you see a sword, it's a symbol of a penis.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure,
and
it's a phallus.
And, right, sorry. And it's just like this universal, like, literary thing, right? And so I think when the swords become like sort of get whipped out and we have this sword fighting, and we have Arya fighting Jeffrey and hitting him on the head, mm-hmm, with a piece of wood, and we've got Joffrey with his sword that it says it's scaled down to as fit as 12-year-old frame, and so, you know, that's so symbolic of who Joffrey thinks he is, right, and who he's been conditioned and trained to be. Is he's a boy, but he's playing like a man. And then we have Arya, who just in her like sort of innocent, naive, but very passionate way, like reminds him that like no matter how fancy his sword is and how tailored it is, that he's not anything that he claims to be. And so we have a battle of the penises here. Arya has one too.
Exactly. And it's so I'm glad that we have another useful metaphor here, but but
I bring so many gifts here. Discussions of penises and boxes, mm-hmm, and all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. So here's what happens from my memory. So Sansa makes a little bit of a social misstep, mm-hmm, when she kind of emasculates Joffrey by suggesting that, are they going to be safe if they leave the Hound behind?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Joffrey's totally annoyed. He's like, this is, you know, he's almost insulted that she would even question whether or not he would be man enough to protect both of them. And of course, that's when he whips out his sword, right?
Yep.
And of course, yep. And Sansa, she can sort of make better with Joffrey by sort of fawning over it and admiring it, and then of course all is well, right? His manhood has been restored.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, I think that at the very, very end of that chapter, you know, we have Sansa, you just said, fawning over Joffrey. She goes over to him. You know, she mm-hmm. can, you know, she acts the part of kind of the maiden who tends to her, to the warrior who's fallen in battle and is, you know,
yeah.
mortally wounded, or, you know, and playing the part of that scene. But, you know, in this case, I think forgetting that he didn't die nobly, or wasn't injured nobly. He was injured because he was being a bully.
Yeah.
And he was hit by a girl from behind. And then, yeah, you know,
a girl
like,
had a
prince.
Bigger stick than he did.
Exactly.
And his stick
yeah.
got thrown into the river.
Yeah.
He has no stick anymore.
He has no stick, right? And he responds, he does not respond well to that overture. She responds in the conventional way that she's supposed to respond, uh-huh. which is this like fawning woman. And he doesn't respond back with the level of graciousness. And I think that this is also, you know, one of the many reminders in this early chapter mm-hmm. that he's a prince. When he wants to, and he plays by the rules when he wants to, but the rules are really there for him to manipulate other people.
That's interesting.
You know, he flips back at her. He's upset. He's mad. And there's also this recognition at the end that he can't solve his own problem, that he needs other people. She says, "I've got to go get help." And then he's like, "Okay, then go."
Right.
When he's supposed to get up and help himself, and he's really rendered impotent multiple ways here.
Huh. It's so interesting. I think that this is kind of, When Sansa yells, "You're ruining it! You're ruining it!"
Mm-hmm.
she's totally right. I mean, what are they ruining? They're ruining the sort of the storybook possibilities of her marriage to the perfect prince, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is the Disney fairy tale that's getting blown up in her face.
Yeah.
You know, and what's so I think interesting about that scene is that Sansa says that too late, you know, that Sansa like strategically and willfully denies that Joffrey is ruining that fairy tale, and that he ruined it the minute that he kind of, you know, kept pushing them forward and going into terrain that she didn't feel comfortable
right.
with, and like not listening and respecting her.
Yeah.
And but yeah, so she's I, you know, blaming Arya, I think, for what has already been ruined.
Let me ask you a question. Maybe this is it's probably impossible to answer, but rereading this chapter again, I was asking myself, if they don't encounter Arya, is Sansa safe? Mm-hmm. In other words, mm-hmm. Joffrey takes Sansa out alone. He gets her drunk. Mm-hmm. He's getting sort of wild-eyed in his drunkenness. Does he mean to harm her?
I think that is a fascinating question, and I'm so glad that you brought that up, because as I was rereading this, I was like, oh my gosh, this is way more creepy.
Yeah.
When you're reading backward than when you're reading forward.
Yeah.
And that is such a powerful lesson, because what, you know, Martin is essentially doing is saying, you know, setting the stage of what violence looks like, right? And it doesn't happen in this dramatic way. It happens by small degrees, and you know, multiple steps forward. And I think you're spot on to say that there's sort of red flags being raised all over the place.
It's kind of like, yeah, it's really sort of the marks of a great horror author is like,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Sansa's an 11-year-old girl, so she can see what's, you know, she can see the kind of the facts in front of her, but she doesn't know how to interpret the facts.
Mm-hmm.
And the facts to, you know, an adult reader is that, oh gosh, there's so many red flags. This kid's nothing but trouble. This is all a lie. You get out of the house. It's haunted. Yeah. You know, that kind of thing. But the haunted house in this case is Joffrey.
Yeah. So, and I think that we're also in a really interesting point with Joffrey where, you know, it's early enough along in the narrative and he's young enough that the reader is asked to suspend the same kind of judgments that Sansa is making about him, which is that this is a 12-year-old kid.
Yeah.
12-year-olds are impulsive. They want to explore. they are bad listeners, they're selfish, and they don't think of others. And so, and all those things can be really innocent. And so as he leads her deeper and deeper, you know, away from, you know, into the woods or into the clearing, you know, you start to wonder and ask the questions of like, well, is that the case? And then even at when you see the episode of the fight, there's moments where you're able to see Sansa's point of view, which is, you know, she lashes out at Arya instead of Joffrey, in the sense of like, well, of course he's going to be mad because, you know, he was disrespected in a public way, or he's just defending his masculinity, mm-hmm. or like, you know, kids are impulsive. And so we're at this middle ground where I think Martin is asking us to think about Joffrey. Was he born this way? Is he really truly cruel by nature, or is this part of just a 12-year-old kid being like a middle schooler? Mm. And middle schoolers are mean, you know, and nasty by nature.
Yeah, he is. Okay, so I think that there's like a rumor that's revealed later in the books that he, like, there's rumors about him torturing cats or something. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, so we don't know that yet about him, right? Mm-hmm. But I think that there's something that we mistrust about him, because he's too polished.
Yeah.
And but you can totally tell that he's, you know, he's got a lot of immaturity, and he treats commoners really poorly. You know, he treats the Hound really poorly. And the fact that he's nice to Sansa sort of endears him to Sansa. What we find out eventually is that because he's been emasculated in front of her, I think he always resents her for this. I think that, like, mm-hmm. tracking forward into the next few books, I don't think he ever forgives her for witnessing him, you know, shout out, "I'm going to tell my mother." And
yeah, you know? Totally.
I was thinking of when I read this when I was young. I read the Orson Scott Card Ender's Game.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I think in Ender's Shadow, there's a bully. And I forget the name of the bully, but what Card does is he says, look, because the bully had to sort of put down anyone that saw him vulnerable.
Sure.
And that's kind of this motivating character for this sort of budding serial killer. And I kind of got that same vibe with Joffrey. It's like Sansa saw Joffrey at his most vulnerable, and he's just never going to forgive her for it.
Yeah, I mean, Joffrey's sense of confidence is manufactured and replicated in a way that is highly scripted. I think one of the most haunting lines for me comes a little bit earlier, when Cersei is sort of, you know, exiting from the from the carriage, and she says, and Sansa says, she heard the queen say, "Joffrey, go to her," and her prince was there, and it. That line, like, "Joffrey, go to her." So Sansa's standing there, and she is like waiting with bated breath for this guy to emerge and to kind of like come running to her, and he doesn't, right? He has to be told to go. Mm. And it's this directive of right, like, this is your duty, dude, you know, like, go hang out with her.
Which, and you can kind of forgive a 12-year-old boy,
totally,
because,
right? You know. Totally. Yeah. I mean, and so in that sense, it's like all of these characters are just so confined and trapped by the destinies that others have constructed for them. You know, like, Joffrey doesn't want to marry Sansa. You know, he's not into girls yet. Like, he's a 12-year-old boy.
Well, right? I mean, maybe what thrills him is, like, seeing creatures suffer. I mean, that's
right.
That could just be who he is.
Yeah. I mean, he's more interested in his sword. Metaphorically and literally, right? <It's Sansa.
laughs> The other thing that it struck me about the chapter, oh, you know what I should do? I should ask you, is there anything specific that you wanted to talk about with this chapter, like a character or a plot point or anything like that?
I think you've honestly, I think I got it to talk about the swords, and so I'm pretty happy.
Okay.
And I'm sorry if I've taken it off into
No, absolutely.
Then you.
This is great. I'm glad I didn't. I wasn't thinking about the swords before, but
okay.
Here's the other thing that struck me about this chapter. So Sansa's freaked out by Illyn Payne, and she almost stumbles. Like, she's so frightened that she almost stumbles, and she feels someone sort of, you know, catch her, you know, stabilize her. And she thinks at first it might be her father. And she turns around and realizes it's the Hound with his horrible, you know, terrible burnt face and everything she, you know, is afraid of. But I thought for a moment, like, from her perspective, ooh, it's the Hound. But from my perspective, I was thinking, he was acting fatherly in that moment.
Yeah.
And she can't see it yet, but there's something more to him, right?
Yeah, I think that what Martin does such a great job of is humanizing these characters and really portraying them as complex and nuanced entities. And so, you know, the fact that I love mistaken identities in literary texts, because, you know, they're almost always by design. Right. And so it is no accident that that the Hound is conflated with the father here, because he does sort of function in that way. Again, not a traditional father role like we would imagine in the 21st century and we would want and hope, but you know, all the essential features are there. And I think it also, what he's doing through the figure of the Hound here and then also later on is portraying people as, you know, we have expectations for how we want people to look and act and feel and behave and what, like, love looks like. Mm. And Hound challenges that because he's so different. Can you hear that dinging?
Just that last one.
I'm sorry about that. Like, I am having the hardest time. Sound taken off, so I really apologize.
It's not a big deal. Hey, okay. I got a question for a medievalist. All right.
Yeah.
All right. So there's there's talk of three different sort of magical beasts in this narrative. Mm-hmm. One is an oryx, one is a shadow cat, and one is a lion lizard. And I can kind of get an idea of what those things are, the way that they're described. But I wonder, are these like antiquated terms for, you know, like creatures we might find in like a bestiary or something like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the first one that you mentioned, and I the
oryx.
Oryx?
Yeah.
Yeah, oryx, oryx. Those are now, those actually, it's an actual creature, and it's kind of like a now extinct form of like a very large cow, or like a I think the cow actually had horns on it.
Yeah.
And so these are most of the time are real creatures, like antiquated or like colloquial names for creatures that either once existed or, you know, were part of the like the larger mythos of animals. Definitely ones you would for sure find in medieval bestiaries. And bestiaries, for those who don't know, are largely medieval texts, and they're stories about animals that, and also usually accompanied by images, by hand-drawn illustrations of it.
Yeah.
And what's so interesting about them is that, you know, in the Middle Ages, you didn't have photographs, you didn't have the internet to sort of Google what an oryx looks like. And so they would circulate throughout, you know, the world. And it also often be like kind of grotesque representations of them, because they're, you know, crappy artists who have like heard third hand a description of what these animals look like from different places. And so that's why these animals, regular animals, take on this sort of bestial, like half monstrous quality to them. So that's what we got going on here.
What about a lion lizard? Is that just like sort of Martin's view of what like a alligator or crocodile would look like?
Yeah. So there's actually there is a lion lizard in medieval bestiaries. And it's kind of like it is sort of a hodgepodge between an alligator and a iguana or a Komodo dragon. Right. It's kind of all these sort of combinations of these figures. And so again, I think it's one of these creatures that's been that has emerged out of myth and narrative. Sure. That would have been, and I think it's fascinating that there's so much of this text that is grounded in the Middle Ages, but then there's so much that's pulled from other kinds of, or the European Middle Ages, right? And so much pulled from other worldviews. So this is another example of Martin taking the best from everything and just kind of putting it all in one, you know, one spot and seeing what happens.
Right. So notable introductions in this chapter, Ilan Payne, Renly, Barristan Selmy. We've heard of him previously, but this is the first time I think we actually meet him. Mm-hmm. We hear about an oryx, a lion lizard, a shadow cat, and that just sort of jumping right into show versus book differences here, I feel like the show captures this pretty well. The difference, the main difference that I could see is that the chapter really goes into this day-long sort of romp in the wilderness that Joffrey and Sansa have, mm-hmm. where they're like, you know, they're stopping for lunch, they're, you know, they're tracking a shadow cat into his cave or whatever. You know, this is, it just feels like it's a day-long event before they even kind of come across Arya. And so that kind of gets condensed. But otherwise, I really couldn't find any major differences between the sort of the key events here.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And I think the Shadow Cat is an interesting one. Like, unlike the other creatures, which did have real life manifestations, there's no direct linking of that term Shadow Cat in the Middle Ages, at least that I know of or I'm familiar with. What it seems to be is kind of like a kenning for a Black Panther,
sure.
almost.
Yeah,
right.
That's the image that I got.
Yeah, that's kind of the word, right? I think that he does sort of medievalize it by turning it into a kenning.
Right.
And a kenning is sort of two compound words that are put together that could, you know, sort of stand in for one single noun or one single term. So, yeah. So there is this element of fiction blurring with reality. The event that they're, or that the day that they're spend is kind of this, like the beginnings of a romantic drama, romantic comedy, right? You know, you feel like there's going to be some sort of romantic interlude. And there's even that one line that Sansa says where, I can't remember, she was talking about what she kind of imagining her day, like what do you want to do? And she says, I want to be with you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and again, mm-hmm. she's 11 years old, so it's hard to not be gross and think about what she means by that. But like, if you're going to read that in this sense, yeah, she says, like, the touch of Joffrey's hand on her sleeve made her heart beat faster. What would you like to do? Be with you, Sansa thought, but she said, whatever you'd like to do, my prince. And so, you know, there's sexual tension that's beginning to form there. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. And then what happens after that is, we already know because of her interior world that she just doesn't understand Arya. One of the things that she just can't understand is why anyone would like horse riding, because it messes you mm-hmm. up and it makes you all sweaty and you get all dusty and gross. And then, you know, Joffrey's idea of a good date is to go horseback riding. And what does she say? She says, oh, I love horseback riding.
Right. Yeah. I mean, she defers ultimately in that moment. You know, she has a need, right? She has a desire. Mm-hmm. She wants to be with him. And you can interpret that for what, you know, what you will. And his response is that they can be together, but not really, not with, in the sense that she wants physical connection. Huh. And at the very, very end of that chapter, when he's hurt and she's rubbing his forehead and she's touching him, the last thing he says to her is like, and don't touch me.
Right? Oh, so poor. See, I can't hate her for very long.
I know.
I feel so sorry for her. This is her.
I know.
It could have gone so differently. They had their nice little meet cute. And he, like, he was her knight in shining armor. The stakes are pretty low, but for her, they're high because being embarrassed in front of the popular kids is like her worst nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one that saves her and takes her away from the horrible, you know, faces of ill and pain and the Hound and things like that. It all could have gone so well.
But at the same time, like, this is such a predictable, like, middle school romance. Uh-huh. Like, these are middle schoolers. Like, this is sort of on either end, right? This is the dream that you have of like what your first relationship is going to be like.
Mm-hmm.
And you get that from TV and you get that from movies. And then you finally get your first boyfriend and he won't acknowledge your presence in public or talk to you right. And there's like, you know, he'll give you a high five and that's the only kind of physical contact you get. Like, that's so middle school. And so I think, you know, like, part of it, that's again where like it's really strategic and kind of ingenious that we aren't sure at this point if this is a dysfunctional relationship or if they're just middle schoolers.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
And now Steve and I talk about the old gods and the new. At season 2, episode 6, this is where Theon chops off Roderick Castle's head and his glorious neck braids. Steve, is it easier to trust a kind stranger or a gruff stranger?
What am I trusting them with?
I don't know. If you meet a stranger, you meet someone new, and they're like effusive. Very cordial. Do you find that initially trustworthy? Are you're more inclined to trust that person or less inclined to trust that
person? Oh, less, for sure. I mean, I've seen friends buy fake gold chains from the most effusive folks in San Francisco. So.
Well, I suppose buying gold chains in the city.
Yeah.
I mean, that may be one of those situations where you should be a little bit skeptical anyway.
Gruff or kind, yeah. I mean, he had a compelling story. He's in the Navy, and they just docked. And he's very far away from the ship, and to get back on there to get his wallet is such a big deal. But he'd like to have, he's like, I got to go meet some friends, we're going to have lunch, those stuff. So I don't have any money. All I have are these gold chains.
That sounds so authentic.
I know. I mean, because the funny thing is like I go out of the house and I'm like, I have my keys. Yes, I have my phone. I'm like, there's something else I'm supposed to be bringing. I'm like, I think it's the chains. It's the chains is all I need. And then I realize in the car later, I'm like, oh my gosh, my ID, my credit cards. I let that be a lesson to everybody. Keep like a stack of gold chains in your glove box at all times.
You never know when you have to go over a bridge and there might be a troll waiting.
Right. Well,
for
and
you.
The thing is, I mean, like, and I understand people are going to be like, well, does it have to be gold chains? I'm like, well, because gold chains tend to be a little more universal. Yeah. They're like, if you, like, I tried it once with a glove box full of brooches.
Yeah.
It doesn't, like, because it's a, that's a niche market. Like a
gold, it really
chain.
Is.
The beauty of a gold chain, and we've learned this from one Master T, is that you can't say, well, I already have one. You know, that's how wealth and class is established here, is not the, the just the presence of a gold chain. Any pauper can have a gold chain. How many gold chains?
All right. Hey, unfortunately, we have to bid farewell to Sir Roderick's lamb chops, braids, whatever we're
yeah,
calling.
And obviously, that's why it took so long for Theon to cut his head, because he was cutting through those.
Because we didn't actually see what was happening.
No, I mean, the
but the narrative being... has, in the story, in the language of storytelling, we have been trained to think of those braided sideburns as indestructible.
Right. I like to think that, like, if we could, if the camera had panned over, it wasn't that Theon was, it was an inadequacy that was causing him to have to do so much of the cutting. It was that they actually had untangled, risen up like dragons and were blocking and biting at the sword. Because the camera didn't pan over, I don't know that they didn't also at least get one of Theon's men.
Oh yeah. And he might have been bit. You don't know.
Right.
They might have hit him below the belt.
Exactly. Yeah. Theon's below the belt is pretty precious to him.
That's true. It is. This episode, a lot happens in this episode.
Right.
You know, you see this major character shift in Theon.
Right.
I mean, just the look of sort of chaos in his eyes after he actually... You know, we talked a little bit about beheading in one of our first conversations about Game of Thrones. And your advice... which I've taken to heart is, if you're going to do that, you got to make sure that this thing doesn't come down like a butter knife.
Right. I knew this was happening immediately. I'm like, I just looked over Heather. I'm like, he is not getting this thing off in one shot.
I mean, it's like three or four, and then he's got to kick it.
Yeah. Oh, that was so rough. He had to kick it off. Because you just picture it hanging there.
I mean, we've seen a few beheadings on this show, and they've all gone pretty well.
Yeah.
You know, relatively speaking. Now, did you shed a tear for Sir Roderick? Because it was like nobility through and through going out.
Roderick is noble, but now he's no longer able to help. You know what I mean? Like, there's that idea that, like, I would rather die than yield. But there is another sense of, well, we might want to survive and maybe even get out of this situation. And not even just get out of it, but maybe turn the tables. And you can't do that dead.
If Roderick Castle has watched as much TV as I have, you wouldn't expect a simple spit to the face to result in beheading.
Right.
I mean, I've watched a lot of television, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
And usually what happens is, if someone's bound, you should expect, if you get right up in their face and start insulting them and lording it over them, you're going to get spat at in the face.
Yeah.
That's just par for the course.
Outside of one of your children, has anyone ever spit in your face?
I don't know if my children have even spit in my face. I mean, I've been,
like, spit up
peed
on. Yeah,
I've been you know, I've been covered in feces that shouldn't have been on me.
Yeah, it's a good distinction.
Right. I mean, there's feces that I would expect to be on me. And then there's feces that I would not expect to be on me.
Right. Like, this one doesn't match the other one.
I mean, I've been in social situations. I mean, I've even been in job interviews where a little bit of spittle will actually go onto my body. Like, I'll feel it on my arm or something like that.
Right.
And in those situations, you have that split second decision that you have to make. Whether or not you acknowledge it or just pretend that...
Or just kill them.
I tend to think... I mean, I haven't led a job interview seminar, but if I ever were to, I don't think beheading would be a good move in that case. What would you do? Would you, like, make a joke out of it? Or, I mean, if you felt a little bit of spittle on your arm...
From the interviewer?
From the interviewer, yeah.
I would probably just look at him. I would hold it up, make sure to get it in the light so that he could see it.
Yeah.
And I would say to him, say it, don't spray it. We're obviously not a fit. Good day to you, sir.
I'm making notes.
Yeah.
So there's an exchange between Rob and Talisa where he's not sure what to call her. He doesn't call her sir, but he calls her lady.
Yes.
And this is sort of him trying to like eke out a little bit more information from her.
Yeah.
And she's holding her cards pretty close.
Yeah. This is it's playful too, right? I mean, he's still got that stark humility and he's a little bit of charm mixed in there, but he's, and
is on top it charm? Of it, I have a question about charm. He's a very good looking man. Mm-hmm. Maybe not as good looking as Joffrey. However, he's a very good looking man and he's got brilliant eyes and a wonderful head of hair. And I'm wondering if that's like 90% of charm. I mean, I hear people talk about, you know, whether someone's charming or not. And I wonder if it's like, well, you're interpreting it that way because you're beguiled by their visage.
Yeah, that's charm. I think here's the thing about charm. I think charm is a ruse. I think charm is a term that we use for contextual attraction, and it's usually a juxtaposition, especially of role. Yes, you're absolutely good looking, so it makes it that much easier. You want to keep looking at him, so now you're more compelled to listen to him. Right. So that is an ingredient, right? You can't be charming if no one wants to be around you.
Yeah,
I think you can.
Let's just say it's like Hodor.
Mm-hmm.
And he's
like Hodor, and you're like, oh,
exactly.
Those
he could say Hodor in whatever kind of intonation he wants, but it's not like he's not a really charming guy.
Yeah, but we have seen him completely nude, and there's at least something compelling about him.
I don't know, man. That was a lot of white paste.
Yeah, he's Babar from the waist down. But yeah, so that's part of it. But I also think that part of the charm, too, is the fact that this is the King of the North. He's just wrecking shop. I mean, there's a legitimate buzz about him throughout the kingdoms, man, yeah, not just in the camp. And he comes over with a little bit of fumbling, just a touch of aw shucks that goes along with his role. And there's something about that that it's like, you know, for a guy who could do and have whatever he wants, he's talking to me and he seems to be a little befuddled. I find that charming, right? So charm and being charming may not necessarily be the same thing, but how we interpret them causes an equivalence.
So I was asking the question about what sort of stranger you might find trustworthy. Mm-hmm. She endears herself to him by talking smack and sort of not really respecting his authority as king.
Right.
And she's one of the few people that's doing that. And clearly he's attracted to her. And
he finds
immediately,
that charming.
Yeah, he finds that charming. And then sort of mirrored to that little chemistry relationship, you got Jon Snow North with Ygritte.
Yeah, who tops from the bottom.
Now explain that to those who may not be familiar with that phrase.
Well, in sexual parlance, the top is somebody who is, you know, maybe physically on top. Mm. And that is usually the person that is in control of the sexual narrative, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And then there's the bottom, which is usually the receiver. And this doesn't have to be a male-female dynamic.
Of course.
Yeah, so, and if you are topping from the bottom, it's suggesting that you are in the traditional vulnerable position, but you are controlling the narrative. You're running the show. So in this case, she's topping from the little spoon position, but that's the sense, right? I mean, Jon Snow would be considered in that position, both when he's got the sword up to her and when they're trying to keep warm in the dominant position. But she, in both scenarios, has been topping from the bottom.
Yeah, I think so. And this is an example of a stranger who is not... He tries to kill her. She tries to kill him. It's not like this is a cordial relationship.
Right. But they do have things in common. They both want each other dead in that particular scenario.
They do have that in common. And I would imagine they both like hiking.
Yeah, it seems as such.
Yeah. And maybe sliding. I don't know. I mean, I do know this. that I was raised not to run with sharp objects, and Jon Snow clearly hasn't learned that lesson.
No, no, that's that talk. I mean, that may be the biggest cultural difference between our modern society and the world of 17.
Life expectancy is clearly different, and that may be the chief offender.
Yeah, it makes me nervous every episode.
Jon loses his magic wolf, and Dany loses her magic lizards.
Yes, so yeah, magic is fleeting in this episode. I was shocked that we were already getting to the Siege of Winterfell, like right out the gate, right?
Yes.
I mean, because it was teased and then it's happening. So I would assume, and maybe that was the intent, that this was another one of Bran's dreams, right?
Like, right, we've begun episodes quite a bit with Bran's dreams.
Yeah, and so we see the Raven, we see there's some going on here. And so I'm like, okay, maybe he's going to figure this out before it's too late. But then I'm like, oh, this is really happening. So there was an interesting use of almost non-magic in that case, right? Like,
right. I really appreciated the scene between Theon and Bran when he wakes Bran up.
Yeah.
I think Bran delivers that perfectly. Like, why?
Right.
And it's almost like, are you stupid? Why'd you come over the walls? Why'd you come through the front gate?
Yeah, exactly. There's that. It's a really, that is a one of the more compelling scenes we've seen so far. It's very human.
Yeah.
There was some of the great Tyrion moments, I think.
I think so, too. Oh, well, let's talk about Joffrey.
Yeah, oh, baby. Yeah, thank you.
I mean,
I needed me one of these. I needed
the guy overdue. That threw that cow pie at Joffrey's face. This just, I mean, like major league aim on this.
This is,
I mean, this guy has probably won awards for cow pie throwing.
And he probably knew it. They knew it too. They said, "Look, man, we got to get you a good seat." And he's probably like, "I don't need a good seat. I just need a good pie."
I want to see a biopic specifically for that guy. Like,
that's right.
In the same way that you would see, like, I don't know, like, Ford versus Ferrari.
Exactly. Yeah.
I want to see that guy, and he's kind of befriends the older cow pie thrower who's sort of disgruntled, and his career ended badly, but now he can be a good coach if he can just, get his alcoholism under control.
Right. So you're going to have to take lighter on the mead. Don't tell me I do my job. Give me the pie, I'll throw it. Look, I'm good at one thing. Throwing cow pies.
He's close going second. Around from village to village, entering tournaments.
Yeah, everyone's like, I really thought you could be something more than this. You don't go pro throwing cow pies. Well, that could change. You could change it.
See, this is the problem with Game of Thrones. We don't get to see enough commoners because they have compelling stories, Steve.
We
just don't get to see them.
No. Well, and also the nudity is grosser.
All right. Arya gets, she uses her second wish.
Yeah, immediately. So this is the thing, right? I mean, this is the thing about wishes. And I don't think, and we always say like, oh, if I had a genie, this is what I like. Yeah, no, but you get genies, genies like charm are contextual, man. I mean, it's like, we like to think if everything's going great, you can make a plan. You can get these wishes done just right. But as we've seen in most genie narratives, it's at least one wish has to go for the moment.
Yeah. It was almost like Jack and Hagar snapped his fingers. I mean, the way that scene is cut, it's right. Like, look, you got to do it now.
Yeah, because he's on his way up.
He's on his way up, and somehow this guy's like a ninja or something.
Yeah. Yeah. So, which begs the question, I mean, why was he ever caught in the first place? But that's not what I'm here for. I'm not here to poke holes. I'm here to...
There are certain fans who would like to hear your take on this.
Oh,
was was he in that cage on purpose?
Right. That's sort of what I've been crafting, because I'm like, how is he this good?
Yeah, yeah.
And in that situation, and it's like, well, maybe that situation was beneficial. So.
Yeah, could be.
But yeah, so there it is. Now she's down to one.
A lot of people die this episode.
Yeah, a lot of people do die.
Poor Roderick.
Poor Roderick. Yeah, really poor Roderick. The way
several wildlings.
for Wild Things.
Oh, one of Danny's.
Oh, a lot of well,
the ladies in waiting. Her name was Eerie. So a lot of her Dothraki servants get killed, and so no more Eerie. And Sansa almost gets killed.
Right.
But the Hound saves Sansa.
He disembowels that guy.
This guy has... He enters that room, and he, like, lifts the guy up off the ground with one hand.
Yeah.
I always think... That always takes me out of the scene. I always think, that's Darth Vader. You're just...
there is an element of, like, I mean...
I don't care how strong you are and how weak the other little person is, to hold someone up with one arm like that.
Interesting.
You only ever see that in the movies.
Interesting. As opposed to Smoke Babies?
Smoke Babies, at the right hour of the night, depending on whether I've watched a scary movie.
Seems plausible.
I have a different relationship to the idea of smoke babies.
You feel like you've probably encountered more potential smoke babies than someone who can lift another person up with one arm.
Yeah, no, I feel like I'm watching an A-Team episode when I see that kind of thing.
So yeah, so we've got now the Hound becomes his compassion and need to protect Sansa has it's sort of been on the table. But this is, I think, our most explicit, you know, where this feels like a dividing line. A dividing line between him and Joffrey, but not to the point where he wants anything to do with Tyrion, right? So, like, it's clear. Like, I think the Hound reveals a lot, right? Like, I didn't do this for you. So he doesn't.
Right. He says, I didn't do this for you. He also says, he has a great line. He says, take the little bird back to her cage.
Yeah.
Like someone with a little bit more political savvy would say something like, make sure that the princess is taken back to the castle or whatever.
Exactly.
He's just speaking it. He's just spitting facts. Yep. That's his character.
Man, when you can lift people up with one hand and disembowel them with the other, you can say whatever you want.
That's true.
That's absolutely And so true. He's out there, you know, and his need to protect Sansa comes from something. To your point, he recognizes her as sort of a prisoner in this case and basically shreds her of any power for the most part. But it does feel that it runs contrary to Joffrey basically said, like, just leave her. But the Hound wasn't having it. So in a way, it was he went off and he stopped protecting the king to go and get Sansa, even though Joffrey made it clear that he didn't care.
There's a couple ways you can read the Hound statement when he says, I didn't do it for you. One way you could read it is, I didn't do it for you. I did it for Sansa.
Right.
Another way you could read that is, I didn't do it for you. I did it for me. I enjoy killing people. And this was my opportunity to kill.
Right. People. That's true.
This episode won an Emmy for creative arts in makeup.
Huh.
And I know that sometimes the way these Emmys work is that you're kind of giving it to the whole season, but then you have to choose one episode to submit. And I thought for makeup, like I'm trying to imagine what was the makeup that would win this particular episode an Emmy.
See, and not that the makeup one, like, because the makeup isn't necessarily effects, is it? Or can
no,
it, can
in
it
fact,
be?
It's this particular category specifies as non-prosthetic.
Okay.
So it wouldn't be, they would have a different one for prosthetic and different one for, you know, CGI, I suppose.
Well, maybe Joffrey's face is way shinier than we realize. And the fact that they can kind of make it so that the camera can actually see him at all. Is like an amazing feat of makeup. Like,
it's actually the actor that's playing that role is actually James Earl Jones.
Yes, yeah.
And the makeup that they put on him is just phenomenal.
Slimming. It's incredible.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
On last week's Bird's Eye View, I noted that Martin likes to use pun names sometimes. And sometimes those pun names give some hint of a future plot point. For instance, Bran means crow in Welsh, and Bran will become the three-eyed crow. That's the kind of thing I'm interested in. And I put out the question to listeners to see if there were any pun names in the first novel that I've missed. I mentioned Ruse Bolton, and I mentioned that he does enact a ruse, and that is a major plot point later on. But a listener pointed me to a little bit more insight into Ruse Bolton's last name. This email comes from Will C. And Will, I love this so much, I decided to just go ahead and read the whole email. Professor Ladon, I got another piece of Game of Thrones name trivia for you. You talked about the symbolism of Ruse Bolton in terms of his first name, the ruse equals ruse connection. But I got something interesting for you about his last name. In northeastern England, there's a stretch of the River Wharf where it becomes a placid, gurgling little brook, a calm place to take a pleasant stroll through the woods of Yorkshire. But the appearance of this stream masks the fact that it is, if local reputation to be believed, the deadliest body of water in the world. There are zero confirmed cases of anyone stepping into this river and surviving. I did a little research on this myself. Now, of course, zero cases. But let's just go with it. Will continues. The source of this extremely high fatality rate comes from the fact that for a stream that narrow, it is extraordinarily deep. The currents are ridiculously fast, and the shores are massively undercut, and there are plenty of nooks and caves for a body to get snagged on underwater. The name of this stream? The Bolton Strid. Strid coming from the Old English, meaning able to be strided. Part of its deadliness comes from the fact that naive ambulators would try to leap over this stream, underestimating just how vicious the water truly is. I cannot think of a better body of water to represent the quiet, unassuming, shrewd, and deadly Lord of the Dreadfort that we all love to hate. And he includes a couple links on this, and I'll include those in the show notes. Last thought. I'm sure you've seen people point out that the shape of Westeros is basically just Great Britain on top of an inverted Ireland. Side-by-side comparison shows that the Dreadfort is suspiciously located right about where Yorkshire would correspond to. Coincidence? Gurm doesn't do coincidences. Sincerely, a fan of the podcast. Well, that is a lot to chew on, and I love it. I love that you've put way too much effort into this. And I suppose that in that way, we are kindred spirits. And that's all for this week.